Hello and welcome to the Next 100 Days podcast. My name is Graham Arrowsmith.
And my name's Kevin Appleby.
Well, today, Kevin, what we've got is we've got a guest called Ian Lovett, who is the director of Blue Venn and Blue Sheep. Those are companies that help provide marketing solutions to a range of clients in retail, leisure, news, media, publishing, finance, and online gaming. Ian is an absolute star, and he has so much knowledge that spans a 30-year marketing services career. I think you're going to learn quite a lot that's going to help your business in this podcast, and he's very, very interesting to listen to.
Yeah, and Ian, not only is he a businessman with all of that experience, he's also a professor at the West of England Business School.
Yes, he is. And I have to say, that's very, very impressive, as is Ian Lovett. Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us on the Next 100 Days podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ian, you and I have known each other for a few years now, and I have been thinking about you as a podcast guest for a long time.
I'm sure that's because I talk too much, really.
We... Nailed it in one. But no, that's not strictly true.
Right.
But what I do know about you, and it was on LinkedIn very recently, as you probably, you've actually run your business for 30 years.
I have, 30 years.
Crikey. Tell us more.
September. Yeah, long time ago, in the far distant past. I think those brain cells are dead now. I think those ones that sort of were there when I started the business, they've died off. But yeah, 30 years ago.
So what was the first business that you ran, Ian?
Well, I had what would really be classified as a direct mail agency called Business to Business Direct was the start-off business.
Yeah.
And that was doing sales promotions in the post for businesses. So we were trying to generate sales leads for truck rental salespeople for a company called BRS Truck Rental, who morphed into XL Logistics, part of NFC, all those years ago.
You probably don't know about this, Ian, but you and I share a bit of a history with British Road Services.
Do we?
I work with them.
Did you?
Yes, I did. It was a recession year back in 1979. And I was doing the year out of my first degree, and I was working with them in the sort of northwest of England, BRS in the northwest, and I helped run a product which hired drivers. So I was almost like a transport pimp, and it was fascinating. It was truly fascinating, and I loved my time there with British Road Services. I really did.
They were a good company. The businesses, the north, the east, the west, because it was BRS West, BRS North, they were all separate little businesses, and all the managers of all the branches were P&L centers. They were all focused on making sure there were no trucks in the depot at the end of the day or the beginning of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
they were all out earning revenue somewhere, and they would do whatever they needed to get them out the door.
Yeah.
Where I started. Back in September 1986. They were my first client.
So you were actually targeting businesses then, Ian?
Yeah, which is why we called it Business to Business Direct.
Ah, right. So yeah, yes.
Yeah.
I missed
it
that.
People thought we were a parcel delivery company in those days.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But it was about focusing, and that's why I put that whole focusing on the generation of sales leads for salespeople, and because they need to be talking to people that had trucks and needed to rent trucks.
What was your technique to persuade them to talk to British Road Services then?
Well, way back in the distant past, before that, Dun and Bradstreet used to run survey mailers to finance directors to ask them about their businesses.
Yeah.
And I remembered it because it performed exceptionally well. I did a bit of work with Dun & Bradstreet in the early days when I first moved to Cheltenham, worked in sales promotion. And I was asked to do the lead gen for BRS, and I remembered this technique. So we used to generate surveys about seasonality. So certain times of the year, you know, things, truck rentals really busy around Christmas time.
Yeah.
So we used to write in maybe September, October, because in those days you need to have a lot more forward planning than you did then because the post was so slow, relatively. So we'd start planning September, October, asking people what trucks they might need during the October, November rush period. Because come second week in December, you know, truck rental falls off a cliff and nobody wants to hire a truck for love nor money. But for the 2 months beforehand, you can't get a truck at all. So we were trying to get them to forward book, to think about it in advance. And we were using techniques like survey forms, and we'd run various surveys during the course of the year, and that would generate a 7-8% response rate.
Wow.
Of which 20-30% would be, you know, good leads for salesmen to follow up and start conversations with people.
That's it's amazing that you're talking about almost 30 years ago, Ian.
So I know.
Lead generation's not new.
No.
It's not new. And it's a thing that I refer to it. It's like relationships with people. You know, in today's age, you try and get from I've met you, why aren't we married? As opposed to going through the whole courtship process that you need to go through. And I think in sales, we're still trying to push people to the far end of the spectrum too soon. Believing that they've done enough homework to be able to get there because they've done their own homework on the web. And people still need persuading. They still need nurturing. They still need looking after. And a sales lead is somebody who might be a little bit warmer these days, but they still need a lot of effort to get them to the end goal of signing on the dotted line.
Fascinated there, Ian, that you're starting that process with a survey. Because in the internet world of doing things, that seems to be something that's got a huge buzz around it at the moment. Certainly lately, my email box has been inundated with people trying to sell me onto a chap called Ryan Levesque's course, which is called Ask. He wrote a best-selling book basically called Ask. Go out, survey your client, ask your client questions as the route into sales. And
yes,
this has all been buzzing around almost as though it's a brand new invention. But here you are doing it 30 years ago, before we've got all the technology of survey monkeys and online questionnaires and so on and so forth.
I think Ian was the original survey monkey, were you not?
Well, I wouldn't say that because I did steal the idea from Dun & Bradstreet. But, but it was, I did one for, because I used it a couple of times. Another one I did was for Hilti. Hilti being the tool, machine tool, building tools up in Manchester. And we did a survey, but differently. We wrote from the finance director to customers that hadn't transacted with the business for 12 months and asked them what they were planning to do for the next 12 months. Because if they didn't say they needed their account kept open, we were going to close it. And they would have to go through the process of formally applying for a credit account again if it was closed because it hadn't been used for a year. 30% response rate to that.
What a clever tactic.
But all they did is they sent back and they said, oh, no, we've got this job on and this job on and this job on and we're going to need lots of stuff. Equals salesman's got someone to go and talk to.
Yeah.
And that was really, you know, coming back to when we initially talked about what we would talk about, the focus. Salesmen wander around talking to people that are easy to talk to, you know, the warm cup of tea syndrome. I'll go here because it's nice and easy. I get a lovely warm cup of tea and everybody's nice and I don't have to really try too hard. And all we were trying to do is start that conversation a stage further on with people that did matter and did have something worth talking about, i.e. they would have a need. Whereas a salesman might spend 70-80% of the time talking to people who had no need whatsoever, but they made a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, if you can start, you pick the phone up and say, oh, can I come and see you next? We can talk to you about this project you've got starting in 3 months' time, what you might need for it. That is a fantastic lead-in. It's a very different conversation to, oh, hello, I'm the salesman from Hilti. I believe you used to be a customer of ours around about 12 months ago. I wonder if I could come and have a chat.
Yeah, absolutely. It does create a different inroad. But surveys, that's the interesting part about surveys, is that I take the view that we assume we know more about people than we really do, and we assume they know more about us than they really do. And a survey or a questioning technique, ask, is a great way of starting a conversation, because I'm asking about you. I need to find out information about you before we can have a proper conversation.
Yeah, and that can be followed up by, you find something out about them, and it's followed up by, did you know that we can help you with that?
Yeah, we could help you with that, or I might be able to point you in the right direction. Because it's not always, I don't have to help you with everything, but I could give you some ideas that you might not have thought of.
Be helpful, in other words. What are the things were you doing in the day that might interest us right now?
I think the key aspect of my thought process around business at the time was that I witnessed that there was a lot of waste of effort going on doing things that didn't, I don't say didn't matter, but weren't going to have any significant payback in the short to medium term.
Yeah.
So I started to get involved in segmentation. So when we were looking at tendering, a client of mine was also a contractor doing lots of building work. And I was analyzing where tenders were being successful and the percentage margin being made and the cost of creating a tender. Because tenders in those days were big undertakings. You had to write shed loads of letters. There was lots of telephone calls to be made. There was lots of compiling of information by one person. So it would take 2, 3, 4 weeks to put a tender together and cost you many hundreds and thousands of pounds. And if you only had a 1 in 20 chance of getting it at 3% margin, it would be like, why would you waste that amount of money when, if you look at the work you're doing in sector C, which may be hotels and interior design, where you've got a 10% margin. So I was doing a lot of work in those early days on segmentation and just thinking, why am I wasting my time talking to half these people? And became quite ruthless about whether to talk to people or not. And my business raison d'etre in those days, I would do anything for anybody as long as they were prepared to pay. And the pay bit was the important part. It wasn't, I'm a direct marketeer, I only do direct marketing. It was, I will do anything for anybody as long as I'm prepared to pay, because I needed to earn money. So the focus was always on, how do I earn money? And I took that focus when I went to work for clients and said, well, actually, everything's about earning money. Therefore, if you're doing anything that's not earning you money, why are you doing it? And there's lots of reasons why you do, and there's lots of other things. But when you're a new business, when you are a new business, the only thing that matters is I need to earn money. Reputation, anything else can be repaired, but you can only get one chance of starting a new business. If you don't make a success of it, you fail very quickly. And focus on customers and revenue is very, very important.
That must have been quite revolutionary at the time, Ian, in the sense that you take something like segmentation into businesses and you steer them into sectors that they're going to be more successful in, that they're going to earn more money in. I mean, did you get kicked back? Were you astounding people at the time?
Oh, go back to truck rental. Mm. You know, my territory is bounded on all four sides by water. You know, he wasn't into segmentation or worrying about it. Everybody needs a desk was another one I had from an office furniture manufacturer. You know, everybody needs a desk. I can sell to anybody. And it's like, yes, you can. But certain sectors are less likely to buy from you. And I used the analogy. People did kick back and people were really of the opinion anybody can buy from me. Therefore, I must talk to everybody. And I used the analogy that there are people that read The Sun that can afford to buy a Rolls Royce. But Rolls Royce won't advertise in The Sun because the majority of people that read it are never going to buy a Rolls-Royce. They had advertised in the Times because there's a higher proportion of the readership that would buy a Rolls-Royce. And people got that message. That was an easy analogy for them to work with. So I found it quite easy to overcome objections, but there were certainly objections. And the same today. It doesn't cost me anything to send them an email. You know, so people will blast everybody and they might buy from me.
Yeah.
But you're just destroying everything.
The more I work with email marketing, the more I realize how much harder it's becoming. And in the last sort of, 10 years or so, Ian, on the consumer side, certainly, and probably the case for business, I think business is slightly more tolerant, but yeah. But certainly on consumer email marketing, typically on prospect open rates, you're on the fingers of one hand in terms of percentages. So in other words, your first 95% is not going to get opened, and you think, crikey.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. You've got to send an awful lot of emails to get any kind of message across, and that's just the ones to get open. Now, I just despair.
It is a despairing statistic,
yeah.
And one that because it doesn't cost a lot of money, The new marketeers, and I use the word new, not to mean necessarily new into marketing, but the people practicing new marketing, i.e. email and social media, because it doesn't cost anything. See, well, you know, they can delete it if they want to. They don't regard the damage that it causes to reputation, not only of their emails, but everybody's emails. And the consumer just turns off it. It's just like fax machines did for fax broadcasts. Remember when people did fax broadcasts?
Yeah, it's funny. I had a client, a new client opportunity, who called me just before we started the podcast. And he sells a very, very fine range of services. And basically he was saying that he receives 400 emails a day. And I note his age. He's in his 70s. Mm. In his 70s, and he receives 400 emails a day. Most of them he just nukes. He will never open them. It's just deleted. But interestingly, he was talking to me about email marketing. So once we'd had this kind of the adult conversation,
yes,
we're now talking about doing it in a much more helpful way to him. So basically, it still happens, but I don't think that message has quite got across. But nonetheless, that's very much a consumer thing. But I do know that I wanted to talk to yourself because, Ian, in the United Kingdom, you're probably one of the leading, if not the leader, when it comes to business-to-business marketing data and intelligence. Mm. And I wanted you to sort of go into how businesses might be able to focus more and pick up on the experience that you've got in that area. You told us about segmentation. Tell us more about that kind of intelligence area, because I know you have some fascinating stories.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for those kind words anyway, Graham. I mean, you know, it's been a long time. After 30 years, hopefully you know something about the industry you've worked in. Mm. But 30 years seems to have gone by in a flash. But the problems and issues businesses face are the same today as they were 30 years ago, in that you can't get through to talk to people. It used to be you couldn't go knock on their doors, or their secretaries would bar you from talking to them. So you have to find relevancy in communications.
Yeah.
And relevancy is down to, do I know you, or have I spent any time trying to get to know you and understand your needs and issues before I barge in with my offers or my products and promotions? So that initial stage, and I always talk to people about, is, do you know who your customers are? And of course, everybody can rattle off 3 or 4 of the top big ones. That's not difficult. I can always mention Coca-Cola, or I can put BT or Eurocamp or Butlins or ASOS on the wall and say, hey, we deal with all these people. Mm. But when you get down, who is Big Doug, who is M&M Direct, who is Subaru, who is Rapid Racking. When you move down the list, can you tell me what they do? And that came about because I phoned Woolsey. Now, in the olden days, Woolsey could have been three things. Woolsey was, obviously, lawnmowers and cuttings. Woolsey was jumpers and socks and other areas.
Yeah.
And Woolsey were cars. So which one am I talking to? Mm. And when I phoned the marketing director, I got it wrong. And he hung up because I hadn't bothered to find out whether he was in. I thought he was in the garden equipment, and he was in socks and underpants. And he just put the phone down.
He was literally in socks and underpants. That's a hell of a thought.
So the first thing is you know, to all customers, even 30 years on, and taking it, is you understand who are my customers, and not just the top ones, but all of them. What do they do? What's the state of their market? How's it going to develop in the future? Even if you're selling data services or telephone systems, you need to understand how people are going to use them before you can have a reasoned conversation. So that's always job number one. Job number two, if I've got myself correctly, is to understand the value of those customers to you. Because somebody like Woolsey is a big name, are they necessarily going to spend a lot of money with you? Are they really the sort of business that has a need for your product or service? And that was brought about because energy company, well, it was office furniture, actually. Office furniture companies would say, oh, they employ 1,000 people. They must be good for me. Yeah, but 999 of those people are on a factory floor. There's only 10 in the office. And you should see the office. You know, it's an oil shack on the corner. They don't want new office furniture. They're very happy buying secondhand stuff. So you have to look at your individual customers, understand who they are, and then look at how your product or service is delivered to them. You need to map money. Who's going to spend money with me and who isn't? And finally, when it comes to communication, what am I going to say to you? Are you in a growing sector of the economy, or are you in a declining sector of the economy? Because not all sectors of the economy are going to suffer from Brexit. Some are going to have a great time with Brexit. So you can't write to everybody and say, oh, Brexit's bad news. Oh, it's going to be terrible for all of us. Because there's a bunch of people out there go, actually, it's great news for me. Go away. Mm-hmm. And I learned that one because we wrote a letter to clients saying, oh, the economy's having a tough time. And the economy's doing well, you know. We can help you expand. We can support you with your racking needs, blah, blah, blah. And a guy came back and said, my company's doing really badly. Do you want to buy my old racking? I bought it from you 10 years ago. I'll sell it you back for 50% of the price. And you feel a little bit caught on the edge when those things happen. So I think it's very important if you're after 30 years in B2B is understand who your customers are.
Yeah, there are some products out there that are just clearly anti-recessionary. I remember working for ICI as part of the plastics business, and one of our product lines was the polymer that goes into your 2-liter Coca-Cola lemonade bottles, etc. And at the end of the 80s, we hit a big recession. Our sales of bottled polymer to Coca-Cola and the like flew through the roof. And the reason was that, particularly in the United States, an awful lot of families who would have the dads would take the kids out on Monday night, take them to the burger joint, the pizza place, whatever, couldn't afford to do that anymore. Instead, they did it all at home and they went down the supermarket and bought the bottle of Coke.
There, absolutely. So those three key points for me are really, really important before you start any communication program to your customers.
Know your customer, Ian.
Know your customer.
Know the value of that customer.
The money that flows from them. Or you see, if you've got customers, and I did a analysis for a client, and we listed their top customers.
Yeah.
And in their top customers were people that only spend £10 with them, but if they treated them properly, they could spend £10,000. So they had big customers that weren't spending lots of money with them, but could spend lots of money if they were treated properly. So they were being treated as a £10 customer rather than a £10,000 customer.
I see.
So know the money that you could earn from a customer as well as what you do earn, because some businesses aren't always going to grow or develop with you in the future. They've had their they bought their £10,000 worth of office furniture. They're never, ever, ever coming back for any more.
Can I put an extra element onto that, Ian? With my accountant's hat on. Again, it's going back to my time in ICI, and we were reshaping the polypropylene half of our plastics business, and we started looking very clearly at which customers should we be segmenting as our primary A-list customers, and which ones should be B-list. Now, there were a lot of companies out there that we had some very, very strong relationships with. And we had a semi-technical plant that we'd work on. We'd research new variants of the product. We'd work with them to develop new things. And we had a good look at size of customer, number of sales, profitability of sales. And what we discovered was that actually the real big sellers were the companies that we didn't necessarily have the relationship of working closely with. And the ones that we did have that relationship with, quite often, we spent a whole load of money supporting them, helping with their development. And actually those customers weren't making us any money at all when we properly allocated the costs to them.
There is an element of... We talked about where the tea is warm, but the same in customer relations. A customer that doesn't shout and a customer that's quiet in the corner is ignored. It's like at school, if your child is very bright and capable of getting into Oxford, they'll get attention. If your child is struggling and is at the bottom of the class, they get attention. The ones in the middle get very little attention because they're in the middle. And the same happens in customers. So you give a lot of attention to people because you think it's the right thing to do, but nobody actually analyzes it.
Ian, just to follow that one through to its logical conclusion.
Yeah.
Once you've helped customers, and I know that this is something that I'm sure you advocate, but once you've identified the customers who are being a drain on profits, if you like, being a drain on your assets and never going to make you rich.
Yep.
You would talk to your clients about decoupling themselves from those people.
Absolutely. Sack your customers. I would recommend any business analyze their customers and they sack the bottom 25%. And I do mean sack. Please go and talk to John down the road. He'll service your needs. We are not structured correctly to service these needs to the best advantage of both businesses. Just get rid of them. Because also what happens is those bottom customers tend to be the ones that shout at your staff and demoralize your staff. Sure. So your staff are demoralized looking after them. Mm. And we all like to deal with nice people. You know, we all prefer to deal with people who are kind and helpful and well-mannered. So we call it money mapping. You map where the money is and where it could be. And you have a Boston matrix. In the top quadrant, you've got treasures. You want to look after them and maintain them and grow and develop them. And in the bottom half, you've got avoids. And when I say avoid, I do mean avoid.
Yeah.
Because the majority, I did an analysis for one client. It was 9% of their revenue a year in the bottom 25%, but 45% of their costs and marketing costs. And when you look at it that way, as an accountant's hat there, Kevin, it's like, why are we bothering with those?
Yeah. And in ICI's case, it was a difficult decision for us, Ian, because it wasn't necessarily those people that were the drain on the customer service people's time and so on. They were actually, a lot of them, companies that were really great to deal with, were really interesting to deal with. Mm. And if you think about ICI at the time, and Sir John Harvey Jones was the chairman,
yep.
I remember him describing ICI as the company where everybody had a chemistry set under their desk and loved fiddling about and loved doing those sort of things. That was the problem. Now, we had these interesting customers that the technical guys got on with like a house on fire. And they really loved messing about and inventing stuff.
Yep.
And we came up with, I remember one invention that came off the semi-technical plant. It was a ring pull for a beer can or a Coke can. And at the time when you pull the ring pull off and you got that piece that came away from the can, had sharp sides around it, it wasn't great to drink out of, they invented a lovely thing with plastic all around, working with the customer. The next thing that comes along is the type of ring pull that we've got now, where you pull the ring up, the metal that comes away flips inside the can. Hey, we wasted one hell of a lot of development. It was a really interesting project to play with. Did that customer make any money? Don't think so.
No, absolutely. It is a case in point that people will do interesting things rather than necessarily.
And that's where it becomes really tough, because the brain says, this customer is not making any profit for us. Step away. Yep. The heart says, oh, this is fun. This is interesting stuff. Oh, it might just lead somewhere. We're really enjoying this. We want to stay with this customer. But we got into a very difficult situation as a business, where we'd gone from 1 year we made £20 million profit. The year after we made a £20 million loss. And we really had to do something sharp to focus the mind. So it was only that allowed us to actually make the segmentation change in the business. The brain had to rule heart. But it's a very, very difficult decision.
So, Ian, the ICI situation was a very, very almost like forced. They had to think this one through. There was a reason to do it. For many businesses listening to this podcast, there's probably not an immediate reason to do it other than the logic of what you're actually saying. It's a jolly good thing to do. Once people have actually taken that money map idea and implemented it and got onto the other side of it, how do they feel then? What's your experience?
Well, we did it ourselves on ourselves back 10, 12 years ago. We increased our revenue the following year by 50%. Wow. Because we're able to focus on people that mattered. So all of a sudden, people were free. The time that they had that was being sucked away by others was free. Mm. So it's a long-term strategy of making sure I've got enough time and effort to deal with the people who can spend more money. And guess what? They do. So without increasing our staff, without increasing anything else we did, just by talking to our existing customers, the bigger, better customers, more frequently, we increased our business by 50%. And we didn't miss any one of the little customers. Or the less profitable ones. You have to do it sympathetically. But what can you expect? It's a massive wrench for businesses to do, okay, because they're actually having to admit they've got customers that aren't worth having. And we all believe every customer is worthwhile. You know, the customer is king. Not in my book, he isn't. Not until I tell him he is. He's got to prove it by exchanging money and services to the mutual benefit of both parties. A bully customer and a poor supplier are no good to anybody. You know, it's got to be a real partnership of you're a good customer. We can work together to generate revenue and services for both parties. So the customer is never king in my book until we're ready to tell him he is. But if you do it right, it has a massive impact on morale inside the business and also revenue.
I tell you what, Ian, I've seen you we've talked about this one before together. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I am absolutely in awe of you and the work that you've done in this space, because there's very, very few people doing and talking about the thing that you've talked about there. And actually, every single business can actually benefit from this thinking style. I know other people talk about it. But basically, you do it and have done it for yourself.
I've done it for ourselves and we do it for clients. And one client got an increase in sales of 11% and increase in profits of 30% just by implementing it in 1 year. Didn't do anything different.
In the spirit of this podcast then, Ian, we're calling ourselves the next 100 days. So what would you say to anybody listening who wants to have a real increase in sales in next 100 days or so? What would you tell them the things are that they should be doing in this immediate period to make a start?
Number one, print out your customer list in full, alphabetically or revenue order, and work out who's worth keeping and who you should get rid of mentally, just for yourself. Job number one is print out the customer list. And there might not be many. There might be 100. There might be 200. There might be 1,000. And work out who's worth keeping. And if you don't know, try and find out. And consumer is the same as business to business. You can analyze your customers and find out which customers are more wealthy and more able to afford your products, or live in the right sort of houses, or have the right sort of car to use. So number one, print your customers out and do that manually.
Could I interrupt you just at that point? That because I think that's in my mind, as soon as you said that, is okay, I'm thinking about that. How would you advise me? You're the coach on my shoulder. How would you advise me to make that decision? It's my first time I've done it, because yeah. I love what you're saying. It's the first time I've done it.
Yeah.
Come on, whisper in my ear. What do I need to think about to actually make that cut?
Okay. What will they spend with me next year? So first question I'd ask, if I was looking at a list, I was looking at you, and real cold light of day, G. Arrowsmith.
Yeah.
Spent 50 quid this year. Will he spend 50 quid next year?
Yeah. As much as that, Ian.
Yeah, I know. I gave you easy credit terms, though.
You know me too well.
Okay. So that was number one, is work out what they will spend next year in a real, real, realistic way. And then what you'd like them to spend. How are you going to get them to spend it? So I made a joke about easy terms. Now, don't tell somebody it's £10,000. Tell them it's £65 a week for 3 years. There's lots of ways of expressing value and price. But what we were interested in is, I've got a customer. He's worth X to me right now. Is he going to be worth that next year? And what would I like him to be worth? And if I wanted him to be worth £500 because I think he could be, what have I got to do to get him to spend that £500? Then reorder your list by the what you would think you could get from people, and look at what you thought about you needed to do and how much time it'll take you to do that. And then you have a plan. Because you'll know at that point you cannot afford to service all the customers that you have in your list. So where am I going to put my effort? Am I going to put my effort talking to Graham Arrowsmith, or am I going to talk to Sean Tout, who's going to be worth £10 next year?
Yeah, so it's about really putting a value on your own time doing the talking and saying, where am I going to get the best return for our spent?
Exactly right.
Yeah, I'd go with Sean, though. He's a better looking than me and younger.
He is younger. I wouldn't say he was better looking, but that would that'd be rude. But he's definitely younger.
And better at golf. But that's
yeah.
But
all businesses should be, the owner, the proprietor of an entrepreneurial business should have that at the forefront of their mind all the time. You know, the question being is that when clients leave us, it comes as a shock. But clients don't leave us generally by catastrophe. You know, they go out of business. They leave us because we don't service them well enough, and they slowly but surely fall out of favor with us. I'm ignoring the fact you serve a shit meal in a restaurant. You know, you give someone bad service. Let's ignore the ones that I could call catastrophe. I'm talking about people that you believe are giving reasonable service to, that slowly but surely fall out of favor with you because you don't actually... they don't feel like you love them. It's like marriage and relationships. You know, there's catastrophes, death and things, but divorces, because they've been playing away, usually caused by lack of attention on both sides to each other. And I think that's what happens in customer relationships as well. So, you know,
were you expanding out on that first point there, which is print your customer list? Or give me all three in one there?
Well, I've given you all three in one, really, because I've given you know who your customers are, And if you print out your customer list, you can look down that and try to understand who they are.
Yep.
You've looked at their value to you because you've thought about how much they're going to spend next year. And then you've looked at what could I get from them? Could I get £500 from them? And what would I have to do to get that £500? So if I had a big customer that spent £1 million with me, okay, mm-hmm. would I change my services to suit them, or would I tell them, no, mate, I can't do that for you anymore, and kiss £1 million goodbye? There aren't many people that would say, no, mate.
No.
They would change their services. And I think that's what I'm looking at. At what point would you change your services and behavior to suit your best customers? Because that's what you need to do. So if you take the top 5 customers or top 10 customers and look at what you'd need to do for them, focus on those areas because they're likely to be 80% of your revenue.
Yeah, that point about quality of relationship is a really, really good one, Ian. Far better have a smaller list of customers that you can give more time and attention to than a big list, and you end up giving lots of attention to customers that aren't actually going to be of very much value to you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happens. People spend a lot of time talking to dogs. So that's really the focus element is focus on where the revenue is. That's Pareto 80-20 analysis.
Yeah.
It's very important and one I really believe in.
Yeah, we've touched on that before, and you're absolutely right. It's something that so many businesses have a reluctance to look at, but it plays extraordinarily well into your thinking in terms of the money map, as you call it, and the bottom 20-25% get rid.
That's right.
And we found, going back to that ICI example, we found as we segmented the customer base that very definitely 80% of the profit was coming from 20% of the customers.
And if it's consistent over time, why are you dealing with the rest? I mean, profit can be inconsistent, i.e. it's spread over different clients each year. And sales revenue could be spread over different clients each year. But if you take it over a 3 or 5 year period, you do get a significant set in stone pattern appearing. And you know, go with the numbers. Go with the numbers. So I'm a real believer at that point, and you go with the numbers because although the numbers can lie, they're not emotionally charged as human feelings. You know, and numbers aren't always right, but they are more right than they are wrong.
It's a very black and white thing, the numbers thing, but and I know you're pointing to it, the emotional state that somebody will have about decoupling from customers that they may have served some years, however much of a drain they are to them. And in your experience, Ian, how would you help the small business or the business owner, you know, steel up and make that decision?
Yeah, if you overlay your clients into a Boston matrix and you put the money, you put a lava map of money, I said thematic, I mean a lava map of money on top of that, what you see is you see the distortion in the treasure sector of the people who are spending most money and or making you most profit and or consuming most of your goods and services. And you see the people at the avoid classification that aren't spending any money with you, you are lavishing a lot of marketing time and effort on, but they're not increasing in size or scale.
Yeah.
You show that to anybody, and everybody, no matter how inexperienced they are in managing business, understands it and says, I'll spend more time and effort where I'm going to get the best rewards. Because us human beings, by our nature, are lazy bastards. We want to do the least amount of work for the most amount of reward.
We do.
Absolutely, we do. Yes.
That's it's a really interesting, Ian, because not everybody will be as familiar as I know you are. Because amongst other things, you're actually, I was thinking about the Boston Matrix, but you're a visiting professor now at the University of the West of England.
I don't understand how that happened either, but yes, I am.
So they, I mean, are they letting anyone in, Ian? Is it sort of a because I know you're an amazingly talented fella, but
I can't believe it. That's desperation.
They're not scraping the barrel at all, Ian. That's all I would say. Not at all. You richly deserve it, and I'm sure the students there are blessed because you are. Do you lecture to them?
I can do, but in the short term, they've got a new business school opening this year, October this year. They've got all the building going up, and they're trying to create a real world group around the university. So the university is not just academic. There's people like me who talk about money mapping and customer selection, and the real world says that might be what it says in theory, but in reality is let's chase the dollar.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's all right wanting to be a superstar and be disruptive, but actually what I want to do is I want to be famous and earn lots of money. I want to be on my yacht like Philip Green, stuffing my face full of caviar, and thinking BHS pensioners, who are they? I don't mean that rudely, but no, there needs to be a dose of reality in the academic world.
Yeah.
And that's why they got me. Because I also am quite willing to share my views. I don't hold back in sharing my views.
Yeah. No, you don't. And we have noticed. In a very positive way as well. But what I was getting at, Ian, is not everybody knows what a Boston Matrix is. So just draw it out for us mentally, then we'll get the point you're making.
Okay, well, Boston Matrix was developed 70, 80 years ago by the Boston Consulting Group to try and understand on behalf of the customers they were consulting, get the board to understand where it was easy to get better results and where the scale of those results would be bigger. So they had two axes. One was to do with ease of acquisition, and the other was to do with revenue or revenue potential. And if you scored highly on ease of acquisition and high revenue potential, you went into the top right-hand quadrant. And if you scored lowly on ease of acquisition, i.e., you know, you're not attracted to my business or I have to work really hard to get you, and you scored lowly on revenue, when I got you, you didn't spend lots of money with me, then you ended up in the bottom left-hand quadrant, which fundamentally was a void. They used to call it, or they do call it still, cash cows, dogs, stars. I can't remember what the fourth quadrant is. We call them treasure, avoid, sales promotion, and development. There are some clients that are worth treasuring. There are some clients worth avoiding. But the groups in between, I'm going to send lots of sales messages to because I need you to spend more money with me. And the fourth quadrant, the development quadrant, is I know you spend money with me, but I don't understand why. Because there's not enough of you for me to get any patterns. So is it because it's my auntie's brother's cousin who's doing the buying, or it's because I've developed a product which I haven't understood that someone's using for an inappropriate purpose? That's why you're buying lots of product from me. So you get a whole marketing strategy behind each quadrant. And that's what a Boston Matrix was.
Yeah.
And still is.
Or is. Yeah. Because it's still very, you talk to any business school and they still talk about Boston Matrix.
They do?
Yeah. Yeah. Strengths, weakness, opportunities, threats, and all that stuff as well.
Yeah, we did a show on that just a couple of weeks ago. And I think it's still a very, very relevant way to go in for any business, particularly new business where you haven't really been exposed to having to do business strategy before. It's a very, very good way of getting your head around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you've taken the Boston Matrix and you've overlaid this, as you were talking about, this sort of almost a lava map. And just so people can catch up a little bit with what that means.
Yeah. So if you were looking down from high onto the quadrant, and you poured out some lava into the center point, you had a jar of lava into the center point, it would flow in all directions.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And what we're getting it to do is flow in the directions where the money is earned. So it flows in proportion to where revenue is earned. So if you dropped it onto a piece of paper and everything was equal, it would form a perfect circle around the center point.
Yeah,
because that's what would happen. But the reality is that's not how water or lava flows. It flows where the line of least resistance. So it creates a pattern, which will be irregular in shape, but in terms of volume is going to represent the treasure sector would have a higher volume of lava than the avoid section because it represents money that we're earning. If you did the same for money that we're spending, it is near reverse.
An interesting way I've seen that lava map done is if you can imagine your customers are dots on the Boston matrix sitting in whichever quadrant, then you effectively take that dot as the center of the money circle for that customer. The more money's attached to that customer, the bigger the circle around it. And you'll see all of your big circles are sitting in the treasure quadrant.
Kevin, you're absolutely right. That's exactly what we do. And then we also run around that prospects. Mm-hmm. How many prospects you've got. And the amazing thing that you find is that the prospects do tend to split evenly between some quadrants. You know, people are chasing volume, volume, volume. We're a volume driven. We seem to have this terrible habit of chasing volume all the time.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that just aren't going to be worth chasing.
Volume. I think volume's a dangerous thing to chase sometimes. Mm. And I can think of some real life examples where a small company has chased volume, has looked at some very big customers, and effectively by chasing that volume have got more and more dependent on that customer for their business.
Yep.
And what that ends up doing, they might look very profitable at first, and the classic company that does that these days is Tesco's. Oh, great. Mm. Fine. We're buying from you. Now, we'd like you to cut your prices.
Yep.
We're now taking 70% of your
output. The dependency on a large customer. Dependency on a large customer is a problem.
The large customer starts dictating.
That is always a problem. You can become too dependent on an individual customer. So you do have to spread that risk around as much as you possibly can.
So if you had to sort of bring us bang up to date with the sort of things that you're doing now, because we've gone through part of that career, the nice thing is that you're doing some really valuable stuff in education now, as you say, but also your organization is changing a little bit as well, or has changed recently the last few years. What are the current things that we perhaps ought to be aware of in the sort of things that you get up to nowadays?
If I went back and met John McClellan, who was my first ever customer, I would say we're doing exactly the same as we've always done. We just need to do it faster and in real time now. So we are getting customers. So our primary business is we get our customers to give us all their data from however many sources they might have, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. We build a single customer view. So we do that first job is let's see who all your customers are. We then match that to a universe of businesses that exist in the UK or the world. And we build a money map and create the segmentation model around that. We drop that into a on-the-fly analytical tool and provide that to marketeers. Those marketeers do their segmentation models. They select the segments that they want to target. And the software executes campaigns to those targets using email or mail or telephone. We monitor what's going on the website against all of those names and addresses that are in the database. And if you go onto the website, we populate that website with information that says, oh, we know you were in Nice last week, Graham. How was your trip? You're going to Barcelona tomorrow. Have you thought about booking a restaurant? Oh, have you got your car rental when you fly in tomorrow afternoon on the 3:30 plane? In real time. And then we loop that back into the database and round again. Wow. So all that's happened in those 30 years is we've aggregated more data together. So the issues have got bigger. The models, instead of just being four quadrants, are now between 2,000 and 20,000 quadrants. You can't call them quadrants, but it's an easy expression to have. There's huge numbers to go at. We provide it in a train of thought, analytics, and execution tool to marketeers to use on the fly in real time. So last minute, we're clients. They've gone to Italy now because they got bought out by an Italian company.
Right.
But it's massive.
Very.
And the databases we're creating underneath are huge. They are colossal. You know, terabytes and terabytes and terabytes of data all being mashed as we speak on the fly, cut, diced, and executed.
This is what you call big data, I guess.
It's large data. Big data is unstructured, really. That's the thing about big data. You don't know what it's telling you till you've actually had a good look at it. This is large data. The database just happened to be large. To most people, it's big data. Because it is.
Just the description of the process that you've orchestrated. And the beauty of this podcast is that people listening will have heard the original footsteps that you took or sort of watched this, you paint a picture of how things were. Mm-hmm. And then the acceleration now to just an enormously powerful way of understanding best customer processing, if there is such, I don't know what the right word is, but basically ultimately doing the right things for the right customers. And that live for customers.
Yeah, it is purely about relevancy, Graham. I mean, I was talking in Vail last year about relevancy. And relevancy in news media terms.
Yeah.
We still want to consume lots of news media. We as human beings are consuming more and more news media than we've ever had. But the thing is, we want it to be relevant. I want to read the things I want to read about and a few extras as well. Mm. If you send me relevant information about my holiday, about my hotel stay, about the car I'm hiring, about the plane I'm flying on, you could email me 5 times a day and I wouldn't be cheesed off. Mm. Doesn't matter. If it's relevant, you know, I'll have 5 emails. That doesn't bother me. You can send me 50 texts. Doesn't bother me. As long as they're relevant. And the more we're doing, the more we're creating, is the desire to try and make things relevant. Which comes back to our original surveys then, Kevin. You know, when you were writing to the FD, he responded because he didn't want to go through the process of having to reopen an account. It was relevant to him at the time. It's going to be a pain in the ass. I'll tell them the bit of information they want. And that's really what we've done. So we've taken something that would take 1, 2, or 3 weeks to do and create an opportunity for a salesman to go and have a relevant conversation with the FD of a Hilti client or a truck rental manager. Through to today, those relevant communications are on the fly. You tell me a piece of information and I can instantly create for you an email and web page that talks about your vacation or your up and coming trip to Barcelona and pull out all the facts that you had. You like eating in Indians or Chinese and nightclubs. You rent these sorts of cars because I have enough information about you. So if I'm relevant, I can email you as much as I like.
I absolutely love that. And what one of my bugbears, coming from a background of playing about with analytics and having been involved with big data a little bit, one of the problems that we've got these days is just having so much data it's very, very difficult to actually pick out the bits of data that are relevant. What you're doing there is in my view, really incredible, Ian.
Thank you. Some of our clients like it.
Well, and you have clients in, well, retail, leisure, news, publishing, finance, yeah. Online gaming. You've got a range of clients there. And you can see that if you were in, I don't know, online gaming, Ian, that you've got a huge amount of data sloshing around there. So making all that relevant for somebody, ultimately there's going to be a time when presumably they go online to place a bet. And I assume that you're helping these organizations get things together to make that bet, the best experience.
Best experience. We're looking to make sure people don't run out of credit. If they're gaming too much, where they should go to next, where they can get help from, all those things. Because although the gaming companies do like you to gamble a lot and assume you can afford what you do, they have to take some responsibility for the behaviors as well. Yes. So they do like to keep an eye on what's happening and what's going on.
Absolutely. 100% fascinating. I had a huge expectation for you, Mr. Lovett, and you have so far exceeded what we expected. And to be honest with you, it's not a surprise to me. You really are the number one person in this field, and we've been delighted to have you on the podcast. Now, Ian, how would anybody who feels that they have a conversation that they'd like to extend with you get in touch with your organization?
They can phone me. Mm-hmm. Start a conversation. The whole purpose of life is you've got to start a conversation. Mm-hmm. And if they want to start a conversation, they can phone me. I can point them in the right direction. I can give them some advice, or I can introduce them internally to people. There is a whole bunch of people that can't afford us. You know, I make no bones about that. There's a whole bunch of people our products aren't suitable for. No bones about that. There's a whole bunch of people that are doing stuff that we can't help with.
Yeah.
But there might be one or two that we might be able to. So they phone me, not a problem.
Brilliant. And Ian, once again, from both of us, I'd like to say thank you very much indeed for joining us on the podcast.
You're most kind, and thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope I can do something else one day with you as well.
Yeah, well, I look forward to
playing golf.
Yes. Okay, then, Ian. Thank you.
Right, so Ian, brilliant conversation. Bye, thank you very much. Well, Graham, another fantastic interview.
I am seriously impressed with the work that Ian's company is doing in that sort of large data space. But I think equally impressed with the advice that is given to small businesses as to how they can actually implement some of these, effectively business growth strategies by mapping money across customers and actually kicking out the ones that are actually costing you, the ones that are drains on your finances.
Yeah, that, just seeing the relevance of putting some theory like Boston Matrix, bottom slicing your customer base, just seeing those things put into practice by Ian and just how relevant they are to everybody's business.
And plus, Ian came up with a couple of fantastic anecdotes and, not so much anecdotes. They were real things that he actually did back in the day to generate sales leads for salespeople. If you've skimmed through this episode, then it's probably worth going back to various parts of it because there are some real nuggets about how you can develop your business, particularly over the next 100 days.
Yeah, and if you want to talk to us further about how you might in practice go about segmenting your customer base, we're more than happy to have a conversation about it in the Facebook group. That's if you go into Facebook and look in the group section, you'll see the Next 100 Days podcast as a Facebook group. It's a closed group. Just apply for membership. Either Graham or myself will let you in and join in the conversation.
Well, It's been a fantastic podcast, and I look forward to the next one. Kevin, I've been Graham Arrowsmith.
And I've been Kevin Appleby. Goodbye.
Goodbye.